It's got to be Toshirô Mifune. You can tell, especially in Seven Samurai, by the firm butt cheeks that are exposed to that movie.
Lots of butt cheeks.
There's sort of a theme of butts in Seven Samurai that I noted. But we're hearing the voice coming, basically, from the butt.
And in that way, the influence of the Seven Samurai extends all the way to Ace Ventura Pet Detective.
Exactly.
And we're back.
Hi.
Hey, everybody.
How's it going, everybody?
Welcome back to another episode of the Crowded Theater Podcast, the only podcast in the world where all the movies are seen in theaters, not streaming, not at home, not cheating, but we're doing it for real. Hi, everyone. I'm Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Cliff, and yeah, I don't put up with none of that bullshit. If it's not in a theater, it's not a movie.
That's right. And why, Cliff? Because the theater tells the truth. How are we supposed to know whether or not Seven Samurai and Rashomon are good films unless we get into a crowded theater and judge the community's reaction? Because otherwise we would have no indication historically or critically of whether or not
through
these
good
or bad of what these are. No, we... Cliff, what are the movies that we're talking about today that we just saw in a crowded theater?
We're talking about the 1-2 punch of Rashomon and Seven Samurai, films by director Akira Kurosawa.
Yes, two big ones by Akira Kurosawa, ones that Cliff and I were pretty familiar with, had seen many times over the years, but Taylor, this was your first run.
Yes,
at Rashomon.
If you ever have a good 5 hours to kill, these are great movies to fill that space with.
Taylor had to be prepared emotionally, physically, psychologically for the fact that she was going to see a 3.5 hour long samurai movie. But thankfully, it was at the
fantastic
Alamo, so there were snacks.
No, I was gonna say, thankfully, it was fantastic, it really did just sweep you away for that whole time period.
Good. No, excellent. I'm beginning interacting with this plant, but this was an interesting thing. We decided we didn't necessarily feel like we had a lot to say that hadn't already been said, perhaps, about Rashomon and Seven Samurai, but we did get the opportunity, not as part of any kind of scheduled double feature, but just because, and this is just how it is when you're seeing movies at a bunch of cool theaters in Austin, we get the chance to do that, and feel very fortunate about that. On Friday night, we saw that there was a screening scheduled of Rashomon, and then the very next day, I think we ended up seeing it on that Sunday, but the very next day, Alamo Drafthouse across town was doing a screening of Seven Samurai. Mm-hmm. So we thought, why not make it a Kurosawa weekend and check those two things out, since it appears the fates had caused those two films to align.
Oh yeah, and we saw Rashomon in the evening and Seven Samurai early in the day. So within the same 24-hour period, we had both of those films injected into our eyeballs.
Yeah, and it was pretty good. It was actually a good way to revisit Rashomon and Seven Samurai, just because I think we first saw those, you know, in like college film school age, like many young wannabe filmmakers do, and saw them several times to the point where we feel like we had absorbed them, there hasn't been much of an occasion to revisit those films lately, except for seeing them in a theater. We saw Yojimbo, which you got the chance to see with us, in a theater, and so we were kind of waiting. It's one of those things where you're kind of waiting for Seven Samurai to play in a theater, so you have the chance to revisit it, and it's kind of proper context, and we got that chance. And so here we are, and now we have a real pickle, because these are really big, important, fancy movies, Cliff, and we are just two jackasses. What are we going to say about Rashomon and Seven Samurai?
I mean, our chief exposure to Japanese culture was through Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and the sayings of Splinter.
That's right.
Too much more sophisticated.
That's
than
about
that
over that is much
years,
as
so
much Asian philosophy as we got growing up. You know that, and don't forget about we learned some Asian philosophy from what is it? What's the one that was produced by Quincy Jones? the Motown one. No, the Berry Gordy one. What was it?
The Last
Show
Dragon.
Last Dragon, that's right. Okay. Leroy!
Leroy.
Yes, I remember in that Bruce Leroy. That's right, Bruce Leroy has a Old Asian martial arts master who fires arrows at him, and he knows as he chops the arrows out of the air which one has the blue ribbon versus the red ribbon or something, and he's blindfolded, and so the guy's like, how did you know which one had the blue ribbon? And he's like, I don't know. And he's like, you've passed the final test, knowing without knowing, and I legitimately would like contemplate that idea of what would it mean to know without knowing, etc., as a child, and planted that seed. So something, if something could get through Last Dragon, I'm sure something got through Splinter, and probably a little bit more through Rashomon as well, some sort of thing. Anyway, Cliff, I don't know, how did you guys like seeing Rashomon in Rashomon and Seven Samurai in the theater? Good time, Taylor?
Good time. Good, yeah. Good showing. I think I said after both screenings, like, oh, I see where you the influence. You just walk out of the theater just chewing on every single scene and wanting to kind of like rethink each scene and just being like, I want to see this, but like westernized.
Yeah, and it's one of those things we kind of talked about it going in, that idea that, you know, it's one of those things where Seven Samurai is so influential, we were kind of curious what it would be like to watch the movie now, because it's been literally remade so many times, and then in spirit remade and influenced that sort of that basic premise of, you know, like the town hires the warriors, that has even filtered its way all the way to like Three Amigos and A Bug's Life and
even
stuff
like
that.
A lot of it feels like Lord of the Rings Two Towers. Yeah. Basically the whole Two Towers on the non-Frodo Sam side is basically a version of Rashomon, or not Rashomon, of Seven Samurai.
It's
the same structure.
Multiple perspectives on.
Yeah, but you have your three virtuous warriors going to a land that's being ravaged by bandits to get together the forces to have a final standoff in the stronghold against the bandits, which are invading, and ultimately kill every one of those MFers.
Yes, that's right.
They actually mark it down by the numbers.
Yes,
the Japanese checklist on all the heads of the bandits.
Yes, no, very cool. No, that is, and again, it's so, seeing it in a modern context, I guess, where I'm sure, you know, Taylor, you grew up watching anime and all sorts of things you've probably absorbed. Were there
Bugs
any?
Bugs Life is actually my favorite movie as a small kid.
Yeah, that's true. There you go. So did you recognize anything in Seven Samurai that you had any echo things that you'd seen echoed in other media from your childhood?
Not one-to-one, but definitely it felt like an adventure that was both new and familiar, just because I've seen so many things of that nature. I think even you pointed out one of the characters feels like Zoro from One Piece, which is what we're kind of going through slowly right
now.
Ah,
yes. Yes, that's right. And interestingly enough, as we learned from the PBS documentary about Akira Kurosawa, or at least I learned, one of his early exposures to cinema was that his older brother was hired as a silent film narrator and would stand next to the screens doing all of the voices and translations and whatever for the silent films, Zorro films, which is a fun thing. So that folds some of those things together. And that's kind of the fun thing. And that's some of the context that the film nerd context that feels, you know, again, talked to death, but that we were trying to kind of give Taylor as we're walking into the movie is, and I'm sure I will give like the hyper compressed version of the bullshit that has been said too many times, but we were trying to like shove into your ears, like, well, you see, like, the Seven Samurai was remade as Magnificent Seven, and then like Yojimbo was remade as it was a Fistful of Dollars, exactly. I'm just, you know, and then you've absorbed, and then we took this but then like those films were Akira Kurosawa like remaking like a lot of Western films, you know, within a Japanese context, and so we kind of just battered all of that stuff into your head. And as trite as all of that seems to talk about, and on all of the remakes and the, you know, yes, Clint Eastwood was in the remake of Yojimbo, Seven Samurai was remade as Magnificent Seven, it is something that, especially in a kind of post-World War II context, it's something that is very interesting to think about the cultural exchange that had to happen. To kick off our actual formal conversations about this, obviously we can speculate as to the meetings of Seven Samurai and Rashomon, but here at the top of the podcast, we must have first pay respects and consult with the spirits of cinema. So we have done a tarot draw prior to consult the spirits of cinema as to what lessons we might incorporate into our conversation and for our audiences to glean in the coming weeks. So, Taylor, draw the top tarot card and reveal it and initiate our formal conversation about Rashomon and Seven Samurai.
It is...
It is the Eight of Cups inverted. So the Eight of Cups features an eclipse on it, y'all. And we actually had an eclipse here not too long ago.
A couple of them.
Here in Texas. We experienced the full darkness of an eclipse not
saw
too long ago.
Saw the ring.
Yes, yes, yes.
Shadows.
Yes, it features an eclipse and also features a man walking away from eight cups, leaving behind some aspect of his life that no longer serves him, some emotional constructs that no longer serve him to move on to something better. And how
like all the Ronin characters in Seven Samurai. There you go. Leaving all that behind and the cups. There's all that rain. There you go.
Yes, very good.
Lots
I like
of rain
that.
In both movies.
Yes, but he's wandering away. And that's sort of where we begin with, what is his name? Watanabe. The guy from Godzilla and Ikiru, who is the main old samurai in Seven Samurai. The film begins with him cutting his top knot, walking away from being even the appearance of being a samurai, and quite symbolically donning the garb of a monk. So that he can commit the subterfuge of being a monk, approaching this madman who's taken a child hostage, and then get in there and kick that guy's ass or whatever the thing is. So you see this fusion of the spiritual and then the martial all kind of coming together in this act of walking away from one's previous self. So I think that this is a good card, and I think something we can return to and glean some kind of wisdom. And it also, I suppose... right away you can see the connections to Rashomon with the guy at the end of the film. Again, in speaking of the Eight of Cups and all of that water in the temple being kind of rained on profusely, and contemplating the evils of the kind of this post-war world that he lives in that's been ravaged by all these things, and yet he at the end walks away from all of that with this child to start a new life, even though he already has six kids, etc., etc., etc. So there's something in there, perhaps. I don't know what. But anyway...
That's what we're here to find out.
Exactly. So the first movie up was Rashomon. We saw that, I think, at 7 p.m. at the Austin Film Society Cinema. It was came out in 1950. This was the film that Kurosawa made that sort of broke him into being a popular director for Western audiences, which was something that was essentially unheard of for a Asian or Japanese director, because that was a new thing that Western culture had not really been exposed to. And apparently Rashomon, and this is somewhat interesting to think about, got kind of lukewarm reception in Japan, and yet went to the Venice Film Festival, won the Golden Lion, and as a result was a huge sensation in the West, and kind of began an association that Kurosawa was perhaps a Japanese filmmaker making films more for Western audiences than for Japanese audiences, etc., etc., etc. So we can look at Rashomon as a film that... Why, Cliff, is it? Is it because it is so intensely subjective? Is it because it's so intensely psychological? What is it about this film that was so appealing that it... it's a kind of brilliant poem of a film because of what it does with cinema, because it uses multiple points of view to tell a story in... four radically different ways, as if directed with four radically different emphases, and in that way, as a kind of bravura, exhibition of directing, now is this kind of becomes this undeniable piece of art that is at the same time allowing a post-World War II Western audience to peer in their own estimations into the Japanese mind, into the Japanese culture, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. I think the appeal is basically, from my perspective, two things, which is one, the central premise is so... good, so juicy, and so universal, the idea that different people see the same thing in different ways, and that premise is very well executed. So that's nice universal. And the other thing is, it is very, very Japanese in many ways. Talking to a crazy medium is just casually comes up so the dead man can speak.
Yeah.
And so for a Western audience to see with the crazy eyebrows doing the kabuki performances, it definitely would have freaked them out as super exotic and the talk of the town, I could see. So both those things together made for a a 1-2 punch of a just crazy. I can see why it was popular.
Oh yeah. No, it's certainly something that. And now, Taylor, what was your take on it? Just taking it in as a movie the first time.
I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that. I never knew which direction each POV was going to take. Mm-hmm. Each POV, while self-serving of the person telling the story, was still very individual. Like, they none of them really had any sharing common factors other mm-hmm. than, like, man takes woman, woman is sad, you know, man, other man has to defend honor mm-hmm. some way. But then even with the fourth POV, like the true POV, it was a very was a surprise. I kind of after mm-hmm. the third story, I was like, wow, we'll never know. We'll have to just chew on it. Mm-hmm. And then we get the fourth, you know, more factual, more unbiased POV,
mm-hmm. where everyone comes across as a piece of shit.
Where everyone gets revealed of their sins and whatnot.
Yeah. So, and I guess so. The basic, and again, it's probably why this film again has influenced so many other films. That the premise is great, and that we see that there is a dead man. There is a, you know, three character. Character scenario that has led to this dead man. The dead man is a nobleman, he has a wife on a horse, and there is a bandit. And yet, when they are arrested, called before a invisible tribunal that we never see in that hyper-stylized...
Never seen or
hear. We are them, almost, as if the audience is them.
We are the tribunal to judge these characters. They all lie... And each of their lies is dramatized. Is given the full force of reality of being portrayed cinematically. They all lie, and yet they all lie in a way claiming to have taken the life of the man mm-hmm. when in fact they did not. They all claim to be the murderer. And then what is ultimately revealed, of course, by the fourth POV is the reason, this perplexing conundrum that doesn't make sense. Why would three people all lie and claim to be the one that killed the man? Then it is revealed, of course, it is because the actual reality of their lives was so banal and cowardly and low and base and unbefitting of their high stature or their pride or their honor, that each of them would rather tell the story that they had, that they killed a man just to sort of claim to be in persona, in appearance, the type of person they wish they would have thought to be, a more honorable person, worthy of their station, worthy of whatever, their mm-hmm. honor, etc., etc., etc. So we have the bandit claiming to, as a bandit, have taken the woman, humiliated the samurai, and then killed him in a duel. You have the woman claiming to have
a rock'em sock'em awesome duel where both guys, where they clash swords, yep. I think he said 37 times.
37 times.
No one had ever clashed swords with him more than 33 times.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Then the woman basically is, you know, confesses that so, you know, she was so dishonored by this bandit that she and the rejection of her husband that she killed him and then attempted to take her own life but couldn't, blah 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 blah. And then ultimately we then get the perspective of the dead man himself through a medium, and this idea is especially disheartening, and we'll get to that in a moment, to who our narrators are in this moment. Especially disheartening to our narrators is the realization that even the dead man lies and claims that after seeing the woman dishonored, stood up nobly and without hesitation, committed harakiri and died, and that is portrayed and given the full weight of a cinematic reveal, and yet then we get another fourth perspective from the woodsman, who is one of our narrators as well, and that in fact the reality
of
the situation...
Who had stumbled upon the scene and saw it all happen in real time.
Yes, exactly. And we'll get to why that... So just to round that out, the ultimate reveal is one that, where everyone was more cowardly and less, you know, assertive or proactive in what they were doing. The woman wanted her husband killed because she never, in fact, loved him to begin with and wanted to run off. The guy didn't want to kill the guy. They didn't want to kill each other because neither one of them were really warriors or people who were used to killing anybody.
They're just dudes who held big swords.
Exactly. So she begins just attempting to emasculate them and say how cowardly they are for not killing each other. And then just because they've been humiliated and a woman is laughing at them, they draw swords and kill each other. And except that's portrayed in all of this rolling around and flailing in the leaves. I love the best, and it gets a great reaction from the audience. It got this genuine laugh as after all this tension of them staring at each other, they each run past each other, trip and fall, and then each one one of them panics and just starts flailing around on the ground, waving his sword wildly over a head, scared the other guys about to stick him or something. And then they both realize they're alone and jump back to their feet and back wildly away from each other. And just the comedy of their sort of cowardice and their inability to actually have a duel, we realize that this is the shame that they don't want revealed, that this is the thing that they're all hiding, that they would rather be viewed as someone who clashed swords 37 times or heroically attempted to kill her husband and herself, or her heroically committed harakiri, than for it to be known that this was what really happened. And again, that in itself has this great kind of, it has a kind of realism to it. It has this demystifying of institutions like honor and station and all these other kind of aspects to it. But the film also has this aspect where our POV on all of these events is coming from that of this woodsman and this monk and this other grungy bandit who have all ended up in a temple that is half smashed and pouring with rain the whole time, talking about how their land has been ravaged by war and by famine and by plague and by all of these things. And yet the moral conundrum of all of these, as it's slowly revealed, of all of these different people lying about claiming to have killed themselves, including the ghost of the man, has made them lose their last bits of faith that there is anything good or meaningful or spiritual about the world. And in that way, even though these in that way, it is interesting to look at how, and this is kind of what's beautiful about Kurosawa as a filmmaker, how uniquely cinematic aspects of the film add a subtext that speaks to the spiritual dilemma that's at work the entire time throughout the movie. The film is lit almost constantly with mirrors reflecting sunlight through leaves. The characters are almost constantly, they have the shadows of leaves passing over their eyes. They are almost constantly, and this speaks cinematically to the idea of intense subjectivity, they are looking up through the leaves, and Kurosawa is filming the sun coming through the leaves and sparkling and sparkling and sparkling. The first thing we see Toshirô Mifune's character do when he's brought before the invisible tribunal is we zoom in on his face and he's just staring scrunchy-faced at the sky. And then we cut to his POV of just a cloud sitting there while the man who captured him and tied him is giving his testimony as to what has happened. And we basically are establishing cinematically the idea that the POV through which we are watching this has something to do with the sky, has something to do with the sun that is coming through in this dappled thing that even when we're on characters' faces, we are perpetually aware of this sunlight. Every time, like when the woman is kissed and her eyes roll back and her eyes are open, it cuts to her POV staring up at the sun. And we begin to realize that this surreal, liminal space in which this tribunal is happening, where first we get the woodsman and then we get the monk, who then are relegated to the background and are sitting in these strong horizontal stripes of a wall and a shadow and sun. These almost looks like a I Ching symbol. We're realizing that this space in which we are in is something that's more than just a tribunal meant to kind of adjudicate this court case, that there is a divine perspective on these events there, which is why by the time we make it to the point where there is a literal whooping crazy medium who is talking to a ghost, it is more revealing of the space that we are in. The idea is we never see the tribunal. It is not literal. Of course, for the purposes of the story, it is a literal tribunal, but the idea is it is not literalized cinematically, even in seeing who or even hearing the voices of those people. Instead, who is Toshirô Mifune looking at? He is looking at a cloud. And where do we find our three narrators? We find them in a half-smashed temple with rain pouring in constantly, almost as if they are in a big stormy cloud. In other words, these guys, the woodsman, the monk, and the bandit, are as three spirits, three demons. They even say something in the beginning about, you know, the demon that occupies Rashomon has moved on. Or you can look at them like a chorus of gods from a Greek myth who are peering in at the human world and attempting to understand, is there any goodness, is there anything of value in the human heart? And that crisis, which obviously the bandit represents, the pragmatic view of just, you know, no, take what you want, etc., yet the monk represents the kind of idealist view, and the woodsman represents the kind of perspective that slices down the middle of that. But what's interesting about the woodsman's perspective is, as we learn, because he is our fourth story that factors into it, that all of the cinema, and this goes on for minutes at the beginning of the movie, all of the cinema, starting on the axe blade over the woodsman's shoulder, pulling back, and crump-a-dump-a-dump-a-dump, he's walking through the woods, and then we see, again, beginning to establish that subjective POV, he sees a hat on a tree, and he looks at it, and crump-a-dump-a-dump. All of these things, this world that cinema is investing us in and investing us in and investing us in, is also a lie. Mm-hmm. It also didn't happen. Because as he reveals later on, he came upon this whole scene in an intense, in a completely different way. He came upon it when the situation was already in progress, and he hid, and then he ultimately stole the valuable pearl-handled knife and sold it, which is why he is having such a crisis of conscience right now. But this whole world that cinema is investing us in, which is our cinematic bedrock, we think, of objectivity, before we even get to the tribunal, before we even get to the different perspective, we realize is also a lie. So these minutes of him seeing the hat, and then going from seeing the hat to seeing whatever, and then finding the knife, and then coming upon the scene, also didn't happen. And so he is also, again, in that way, not just a, you know, a unreliable narrator, but his intercession in these events is almost spectral in nature, because all of the story that we're witnessing is the story he gave to the tribunal, his rationalization, his justification for why he was there. We're not seeing the reality of the situation. And so when that is revealed, you know, we kind of realize that this story that's framing the story, these three men held up in this sort of smashed temple talking about the woes of the world, are, and who are then lingering ever present in this kind of weird, again, numinous liminal space where all of the sudden, you know, people are talking to this sky presence about their sins and about trying to rationalize who they were versus who they really were, is that they are, is that it is the sky's perspective. It is these, they are cloud people. They are a few interested gods checking out what's going on and attempting to literally pass judgment over the whole of humanity, which ultimately, I guess, was, again, is revealed in that final shot where the bandit attempts to just take the kimono from the baby. The monk is, you know, lost faith in humanity, and yet it is the woodsman who already has six kids and is already burdened with these things, who suddenly finds this spark within himself to take this baby home with him and raise it. And that baby is, of course, all of humanity, as the gods have now judged us favorably after this crazy time of plague and war, which we would have just been coming out of as a society. And in fact, there is enough of a seed of goodness that that will blossom into something else, blah, 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 blah. And again, I imagine that at that time, in addition to, you know, the fact that the film was fucking cool as shit and all of that and really well made, for a Western audience that has just made it out of World War II was a pretty resonant message, and that's something that also seeing it from the side of the people who they just bombed the shit out of was probably added an extra bit of emotional resonance to the thing. So anyway, it's a cool movie.
We don't know how that temple got smashed. It could have been the A-bomb.
I think that's exactly what happened. It literally blasted them back to the Stone Age.
There you go.
And stuff like that. So
I will throw just you've basically a retelling of what you have just saying, but I also like the idea of, it's obviously a more Christian idea, but as they are talking to the tribunal, this liminal space, it almost feels as if it's like a purgatory-esque space.
Yes, trying
to decide whether or not they are judged to go into heaven or hell and whatnot. Obviously, just a retelling of like the gods or, you know, the POV looking in, but it's just kind of unique how they literally can be just translated to that, to a Christian audience, to a Western audience. It is very transgressive in that way.
No, I mean, that's the thing is, I like, I think that's one of the cool things about it is that I'm not, it's not one of those things where the symbolic idea is the more important one to be conscious of. I mean, the film has a tremendous plot. It all works on the very literal level.
It's engaging from the get-go.
But it's these choices of, it's the film does, it's on two levels. The choices that the film makes about what to literalize, that is to say the tribunal is never literalized, we don't see their face, blah, 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 you know, speak to, obviously, the themes and speak, obviously, to this perspective, perspective that transcends the human perspective. And yet the film is at the same time about these four different perspectives, these human perspectives, and their wild disparity from some capital T truth that is out there that only the cloud man, the woodsman who sits between the monk and the bandit, can kind of discern, can split with his axe, if you will, his mind, you know, just speaking of the tarot, the axe or the sword being the mind, and he is the one who has to make the choice at the end, just to take the baby or not take the baby with him. And we then realize
Much
like the Eight of Cups, exactly. That's right. That's true. He does have his cloak wrapped up here, and perhaps under this cloak he has the tiny baby and stuff like that. And I don't know. It's
I see the resemblance.
Yeah. And of course, in this film, we have the playing the bandit. You have just about the best actor you could have playing anything in anything, Toshirô Mifune. Taylor, how is we were trying to remind you that because you had seen both High and Low and Yojimbo, so you'd seen Toshirô Mifune in something else. How'd you like him in this movie?
I really liked him. I think he's got a great face. I think he's got a
he sure does.
He does have a great face, and he's just very, very enjoyable on screen. He just has a very.
But you did not like him at all in the beginning of this movie.
Did I not?
Well, I know when the girl's trying to stab him in the beginning, I remember you're like, get him. The character, you were like, I don't like him.
Maybe.
Because he's
not
a bandit.
No, maybe.
And he was scratching himself all the time.
Itchy. He's very itchy. Scabbies.
Yes.
No, but otherwise his comedic, or his character is throughout the film, is very enjoyable.
No, I did notice him win everyone over, especially, I think it was I liked about watching you watch the movie is how thoroughly I knew that there would be multiple perspectives in Rashomon, I'm sure, prior to having watched it the first time, which is probably when I was in film school, but we did not really.
I thought we were talking about Seven Samurai. No, I do remember not liking the bandit still at Rashomon. I thought we had moved on to Seven Samurai.
I did not like the rapey bandit. I did not care for the rape, in fact.
It was my least favorite part
of
that.
Least favorite part. No, I did like watching you fully invest in the perspective of the first story, the bandit story, as reality, because why wouldn't you?
He tells it so invigorating.
Yeah, and the assumption is this is the plot of the movie, and we will proceed on to subsequent events from here. And then got to kind of feel you get the second story, the POV of the woman telling her version of the story, which is very weird and intensely different, where she ends in the perplexing way where she lays claim to having killed the person, etc. So I'm curious, what was that experience like, kind of beginning to see the premise of the multiple POVs reveal themselves?
It was kind of interesting, because again, I did not care for the braggadocious nature of the bandit up front, but obviously he was going to bolster his reputation as much as possible, because ultimately he did get caught nonetheless. And then you kind of immediately almost forgive him, because the woman is like, but he was so honorable, like he still, you know, took my honor, but he felt bad, or he had this kind of like more of like a caring nature to him, where you almost kind of do feel like there was an element of her genuine being like, and he was so handsome.
Yeah, I think there's aspects of that for sure throughout.
Would you kind of, as the audience, you're like, okay, I can kind of see that, and you start to, as an audience, realize, okay, you're and you're not seeing the truth. Mm. You're kind of having to figure out the truth. And I myself like stories or even just like mystery novels of like, okay, well, what is the truth? What is this unreliable narrator telling me? And so, and again, as a female, I can kind of see that POV a little bit more, understandably so. And then you get to
the ghost story,
which you, as myself, thinking, bless you.
Thank you.
That there's going to be the rule of three, and a much kind of almost maybe even personally side with the priest, thinking, well, the dead don't lie. Dead man tell no, you know, what I've said, et cetera. Yeah. And so I was just ready to be like, okay, well, whatever the dead man says is truth. And then I was very surprised and very even more engaged, more excited that there was a fourth POV that is very much a like, wait, I was not expecting this. I was not ready for this. I was ready to wrap up, and I was, you know, and got a much more invigorating last story.
Yeah, yeah. And one that kind of, in the best way, as the final punchline, upends even those parts of the film that we thought were truth in the beginning, like the Woodsman stuff, immediately we realize are also just another non-existent thing, another sort of phantom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all cool, and it's really good, and Toshiro Mifune's really awesome in it. But yeah, the consistency with which that visual idea is constantly hammered through. There is not really a shot where there's not sunlight hitting them, and I found out that they in fact use mirrors and stuff, but it is one of those things where just from that kind of constant emphasis on the sun both hitting their face and looking up, it is an idea that is purely cinematic and yet charges all of these things with meaning that I don't think even necessarily has to be conceptualized. I think we kind of get it, that we're both their perspective looking up at the sun and the sun's perspective looking down upon them, and the cloud looking down upon Toshiro Mifune is the tribunal. We are the tribunal as the gods sitting in clouds judging these movie characters, but these you know, story characters who are being kind of portrayed, directed, if you will, in four intensely different ways based upon their own POV of their own life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know, that is just, we talked a lot about in the Here podcasts and everything else about the POV of the camera, the POV of us into a movie is a spiritual POV. It is the God's eye view. It's interesting that right now, I think Steven Soderbergh has a horror movie out where, you know, the camera is the ghost. And we obviously talked about Robert Altman's Images being a very influential movie where the camera is the ghost. But this is, again, one of those things where you feel Kurosawa, and I think this is why the film kind of intensely, you know, still has a look to it that even feels kind of otherworldly, is that it kind of is this very simple idea that underscores all of the themes of the thing. I don't know. Or maybe I'm crazy or whatever.
Think it's a very good observation. I think there's a reason why the movie has kept stayed a strong influence in a lot of movies that you see, even like TV shows and sitcoms I've seen. I think even more so now, I think you see that use of the Rashomon storytelling in shows.
That's true. There's one episode of Frasier and others.
That's right. They did a Rashomon Frasier where there's multiple perspectives. So Cliff and it was a Christmas episode, I think we rewatched not too long ago.
It's just standard sitcom plot at this point.
That's right.
It's worked his way into the
And there
the
was
plots.
An episode of Community that's all about their Chaos Theory episode, which is essentially six different potential things, but they also do include multiple subjective perspectives on the same events, and I'm sure it's been parodied a number of other times. But since we're about halfway through, I think it is good that we transition into the 3.5 hour long Seven Samurai, a film that came out
with an intermission that was on.
Yes. When we saw Godfather 2, we were Taylor was quite disappointed. They put up the intermission tag for a second, and everyone got up, and then immediately the second half of the movie started without interruption. This time the intermission tag went up, and then we actually got a 10-minute intermission, which was nice because
I was sitting in the chair. I'm like, you're not going to get me this time. And then it actually was
intermission. It was a real intermission, which was nice. So this film came out in 1954, but was a big hit in both Japan and the West, and of course was remade as The Magnificent Seven, and became one of the which also became a huge culturally influential, you know, thing, only amplifying the influence of Seven Samurai in the West tremendously, and is a really good movie. What do we say about The Seven Samurai, other than it has created, you know, a bunch of different dramatic and action movie warrior archetypes that have permeate pop culture, permeate comic books literally right now. I think whatever Zack Snyder's last 5-hour bajillion dollar Netflix epic that Rebel Moon, right? Is it? It's called
something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Is some sort of, I presume, I have not seen it, some sort of space opera remake of Seven Samurai, I guess. You know, because the space people are taking everyone's rice or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But anyhow, it's just the fantastic premise, of course, is that the simple, common people of a town hire some ronin, some masterless samurai, and again a period blighted by bandits and war and all sorts of things.
They're told to look for a hungry samurai because all they have to offer them is food, and not much food at that.
That's right. And they feel they have these men who have kind of fallen from places of honor and to varying degrees are looking to uphold that honor in some way as their sort of purpose in life, looking for a battle, looking for something honorable versus the non-honorable samurai who they encounter, who are interested in sort of the much more transactional version of honor where they should be paid lots of money, etc., etc., etc. And I think this obviously reflects things in Kurosawa's life. He came from a samurai-type family. He felt that he had fallen in some way from a place of honor by pursuing the kind of more Western bohemian filmmakery type life in some way, and was attempting to live up to that honor in some way. But you also, I couldn't help but feel also putting together this team and this plan and this again, too much has been said about, you know, well, you know, the movies like Inception are really about filmmaking. You know, it's often a boring conversation to have, but I couldn't help with this film and realize how much of the planning and orchestrating of the battle plan felt like a film director and many other people putting together a film. Now, here's the question. Who gives a shit? And I'll tell you why. The reason this resonates more with me now, certainly, than it did when I was younger, is the fact that even the film world sometimes feels like a world full of ronin and masterless samurai, in the sense that, you know, there was a high period at one point where there was a lot of gold and prosperity and people became members of great houses and there were lots of directors telling great stories and with a lot of gold behind them. And now, in this world plighted by plagues and war and famine and all of these things, we are in this fallen period, but a period in which there's still all of these masterless samurai wandering around. And whenever Cliff and I have put together a film production, and we've put together a few over the years, there is usually...
We're looking for hungry samurai.
We're always looking for hungry samurai, exactly. That is to say that, yes, there is a world out there where people are paid big bucks to make movies and, you know, and join unions and do all of that kind of stuff. But there is also, and especially more so than there used to be in these days, a lot of masterless samurai wandering around who are very hungry. And we have to parse in all of our conversations with people going into a movie, well, who is a ronin who is interested in it for the money, and who is a guy who is looking for that next battle? Who is that guy who is... and this is perfectly encapsulated with Watanabe's conversation, I forget his character's name, with one of the first samurais he brings on, not the enthusiastic young rich kid, but the other guy. He says, you know, I want to let you know, this battle could kill us both. And the other guy just has a big smile on his face and starts nodding. And he says, that's what you're looking for. Someone who on some level is willing to die for the thing, the honor of the thing, and is willing to do that. And there is an unspoken thing between people, and I think it permeates many different worlds. You know, it's present in the sport world, it's present in filmmaking, anywhere where the people have a kind of religious fervor for For what they do, you know, there are those people who I think resonate very, very strongly, for the same way that Rocky resonates to people beyond people who have boxed before, people who feel like they've been beaten up but actually went the distance and there is something honorable in it, etc., is transcendent. I think there is something transcendent about seeing these fallen samurai cut off their top knot in the beginning, commit to some sort of more spiritual path where they realize that as men, they're just going to do what they've always done. And they're going to do it very, very well. And they're going to do it to the very, very best they can. And again, the main samurai, Watanabe's character, he says that I've been in many battles, but I've only much more seen the losing side than the winning side of battles. So he's just going to keep doing it and find other men who are going to do it with him, because for some benefit that transcends money, that transcends the institutions that gave birth to them being samurai, etc., etc. And even that whole scene at the beginning in the market, as we're, again, speaking of the intensely subjective POV, like a tennis match, we're watching him watch just the faces of men walking by. One guy walking by, another guy walking by. One guy, and the camera just ping-ponging from faces until he sees a guy, and he says, that's the guy. And the first test essentially is a test of whether or not they have psychic awareness of whether or not a guy is going to hit them with a stick when they walk through the door. So he is literally looking for something that is transcendent, that is spiritual, that transcends the human. And when he finally finds that in a few other guys, again, another humble wood-splitting guy who is the giant and a bunch of people, then that's it. And it's they have even the kind of grungy bandits who are present in the little halfway house where they're leaving are shouting at them, but you who very much similar to the grungy bandit in Rashomon, but they're going to feed you rice and millet and you're going to eat this crap and you're going to blah 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 blah. And they're all fine with it. They're like, yeah, but, you know, and then there will be a battle and maybe we'll die and we're just going to do the thing, you know, we're going to do it, but we're going to do it. We understand this secret that no one understands, which it was never about the money. It was never about the gold. It was about this other thing. And he can just tell which guys possess this spiritual intuition are the guys who understand that is the thing. And I have to imagine, as someone who has marshaled teams of people to make movies many times, as Kurosawa did, and he's walking, you see it in those shots where they're just walking around to the problem areas and saying, oh yeah, we're going to have to flood this area, get a lot of rain in here and all this. It just feels like he is exercising that aspect of it. I don't know. Anyway, and I don't know, making a statement about that I think is transcendently resonant for all contemporary men who, in a world, again, post-World War II, where the previous institutions of spiritual meaning and all of these other things felt like they had fallen in the West and definitely in Japan, what does one do? What does one do now that one is a masterless samurai? One conducts oneself with honor, but you become the temple, etc., etc., etc. What does one do as a filmmaker when all of the coffers of gold dry up, etc., etc.? Well, you just keep rolling. You just keep making movies. Why not? When we were doing in the sports documentary world, Cliff, you have seen thinking of the Daisy Fresh example and mm-hmm. how that applies. You want to explain that?
Or, well, what's the relevance to this?
Just the idea of Daisy Fresh, who those people are. They are not unlike masterless samurai who sleep and live entirely inside of a dilapidated laundromat, or at least did for a while, just literally sleeping on mats on the floor, cooking over, like, Coleman stoves in freezing temperatures just so that they would not have to work jobs and pay rent and could just train as jiu-jitsu guys all day long. Again, in some where were they located?
They somewhere in Illinois.
Illinois, yes.
But yeah, very cold place, dilapidated. It was a former laundromat called Daisy Fresh. But yeah, they have moved out since. But yeah, basically, it was just guys showing up who had no jobs or prospects or anything, or some who did. And gave a lot of that up. In fact, there was a guy who left a 300,000-a-year job in Australia.
He was the young samurai. He's the young samurai exactly. from the thing who gave up the rich life to go and...
Exactly, exactly, right. exactly. all just because they are inspired by wanting to learn jujitsu. And you go to jujitsu, and there was a reputation that there was some good jujitsu at this gym, and you could sleep on the mats. Yes. The owner wouldn't kick you out, and so there they came.
And not coincidentally, the word jujitsu, of course, is derived from jujitsu, which comes from Japan. And so in a weird way, this art, martial arts, and this, we're talking about, you know, Bruce Leroy and the Last Dragon and fucking Splinter carrying with them these kind of conduits of meaning that sort of continue to permeate and resonate even in Western culture throughout the world. We realize that even something like jujitsu has carried with it a culture that is, seems somewhat similar to this samurai culture, to the extent that there appear to be people who are doing jujitsu for its own sake. Not unlike the filmmakers, they are rolling, they continue to roll just because they realize that something about doing the thing very well and getting better at the thing is filling other coffers somewhere else that with lots and lots of gold, you know, not unlike these cups that will eventually be overflowing with gold. Yeah. There we go. I'm bringing the card back into it.
It's an end in itself. It's a self-sufficient end
Yeah, no, that doing the thing sharpens something else, that there is something else, this sort of spiritual reward for whatever it is that we do that kind of transcends the material rewards, and whether or not they will actually, you know, come within the span of one's lifetime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because because there is something within the act itself, there is something within the doing that is not actually wedded to the material reasons for its existence. There is something about being a samurai that doesn't actually have to do with being the enforcer for a feudal lord within a hierarchical system. There is something about being a filmmaker that has nothing to do with media as a word, you know, has nothing to do with producing pieces of media for profit. There is something that has to do with being a jujitsu guy that has nothing to do with necessarily winning fights or with competing within tournaments and bringing home hardware and getting a sponsorship deal with some gi company or whatever. That there is some other muscle that's being built that, if you are wise enough and you have the level of spiritual intuition where you know whether or not a guy's going to hit you with a stick before you walk through a door, or at least you have what that symbolizes, then you are in this secret fraternity, you know, this silent fraternity of people who know something that the others don't. And I think that that is perhaps, I think, on some level, in the same way that Rocky has had the movie Rocky has had a kind of perennial transcendent effect to be able to inspire people to, you know, that's why people watch it and go, you know, lose 300 pounds or do whatever the hell they do. I think in the same way, and perhaps to a more powerful extent that has kind of been more culturally ubiquitous, Seven Samurai carries with it this incredibly resonant message that is especially more resonant now, perhaps in a more tumultuous period of the world, post plagues and war and famine and other things that we have not experienced anything like they did in the 40s, but it is something that is more resonant perhaps in a period, a fallen period, than a period of great prosperity, when people are like, why do we keep doing the things we keep doing? And then the question, the answer is just keep doing them. Just be excellent to each other. Keep doing the thing excellently and the meaning will reveal itself. And that, I think, is a somewhat universal idea that exists both within the Christian West and the not-as-Christian Japan.
Smaller percent Christian, smaller especially percent in Christian. The 1500s.
That's right. In honor of the Zen masters of Japan, I've switched to green tea from coffee for this, so which they would drink before their meditations. Yeah, and I don't know. And that's the thing, is that, you know, we could talk a lot about how good Toshiro Mifune is and how amazing that they had six rain trucks and were shot in all of this incredible rain, so everything looks so brilliantly cinematic, and how God and the spirits within the film are represented by wind, and then this wind would be picked up on by Steven Spielberg and his films, and then Chris Columbus in his films like Home Alone, to bring it back to Home Alone. You know, the presence of spirits is always occasioned, and yeah, Nosferatu's presence of spirits is always occasioned by wind. So this idea, these ideas that kind of are these kind of transcended spiritual ideas, which, again, as a young and dumb filmmaker who was only interested in how to make kick-ass samurai movies with a bunch of rain and a bunch of swords and a bunch of stabbing, was definitely the level on which I appreciated the film. And yet, on this level, like, literally, we were probably, like, as a seeing it as, like, an older person now, not old, but older, I were probably, like, 20 minutes into the movie, and just him, like, putting together a team of guys was, like, legitimately emotionally affecting for me. And I'm, like, wiping away tears. I'm like, why is this so emotionally affecting? Mm-hmm. It's like, he's just trying to find other guys that get it, man, that get that there's more to it, man. And, like, there's just something about that that is, you know, universal. That, and by the time we make it to the end and all of the rain and all of the that, you know, it's obviously works, but it was, like, right away, something very, very universal and resonant that I've been pawing at with words for the last 25 minutes of jabbering. But hopefully we can glean, the audience can glean something from that as they walk away into their next step. Kyle holds up the Eight of Cups and stuff. I had eight cups worth of emotions during this, all the 3.5 hours of this film. So yes, anyway. Well, cool. Well, I know we've been talking about this for a while at this point. I don't feel like we've mentioned hardly anything about the movies at all, except for just talking about how cool and meaningful they were.
I feel like these movies are kind of movies that you've either already seen or you've either heard about, so or you've seen the influences. So I don't know if you necessarily need to break down.
And, for sure. And that's the other thing, is that I am sure there are people who have talked to death far, far better each sequence in the film and all of that. I love the great character of the swordsman who you brought up before, who has his fantastic duel. And again, that idea that a man wears just on his face is actually made textual there as well. You know, his spiritual power is he observes the one guy with a tremendous amount of bravado shaking his stick and everything, shaking his sword ultimately, and then he observes the other swordsman meditating perfectly, and he says, well, this is something like this is a farce, or this is a charade. And so the answer is so clear, because he knows obviously who's going to win the fight before the fight even begins. And again, that is that idea that you can see on, again, it's the idea that's enforced in all of the shots of the faces prior to that, that this extra thing, this suit of spiritual armor, is observable if you know what you're looking for. And I would say that that truly does lay with my experiences in life, and I think the experiences of lots of other people in life who, I think, as they get older and as you develop intuition and you develop a gut and you develop some spiritual armor, you increase the vibrational frequency of your aura, there are people around you who you feel like you can just know whether or not they're worth anything just by looking at them and just by talking to them for a few minutes. And whereas there are other people who you just look at or talk to for 2 minutes and alarm bells start ringing. These, I believe, are called red flags, right? According to your generation, isn't that right,
Taylor?
Yes.
Alarm bells going off, red flags.
Exactly. And so, I don't know. That is fantastic. And again, one of the there's not much that we can add to all that has been said about Toshirô Mifune, but what is really amazing about this role is he's basically plays a dog in this film, holding this giant sword over his shoulder. Talk about things that have been super influential in the anime world, just this guy carrying a giant oversized sword over one shoulder the entire movie, who is basically a dog at the beginning of this movie, scratching around, following the different samurai. It's, of course, revealed that his contempt that he expresses for the farmers. He has all this, farmers are murderers and liars and all this other stuff, is because he was born a farmer and he hates himself for his low birth, you know, as opposed to all of the other samurai's high birth. He is the opposite of that. And all the armor and stuff he has on him, he's just stolen. He even has the scroll of his lineage, which is that of a 13-year-old boy, which not only makes him not a samurai, but also also the kind of person who would steal a lineage scroll from a 13-year-old boy, blah, blah, blah. And they all have a good laugh about that. And of course, he, in the end, is the one who kills the last guy, dies, actually asserts his honor. It is he, after the first samurais die, the woodsmen and the other guys, it is he who raises the banner of the seven samurai, and he is the one who kind of, again, with all of that whipping wind going the whole time, the one who keeps alive the flame of their honor and all of this in this low moment, and he earns all of that honor by the end of it, even though, and of course, and there's that beautiful moment where he is spitting all of his vitriol about the farmers the whole time, and then he just on a dime turns it and says, "It's all your samurai's fault for doing this and this and this," and he goes, "My," and he's like, tears in his eyes, and he's like, "You were born a farmer, weren't you?" And he goes, "Ah," and he runs away, and he's very sad. And it is a very, I don't know, just very good, very, very good.
He's a great actor.
Yes, great, no, great actor, great moment, great script. Chase. Great everything. Everything's great. We could talk about everything that's great about Seven Samurai for a long time. The young, idealistic samurai, not unlike the guy at Daisy Fresh Jiu-Jitsu, Cliff, who actually came from a background of substance, you know, wants to earn his honor, wants to get in the mix, and looks up, of course, to the swordsman, who goes, I love, the, again, the moment where the swordsman just runs off and comes back with the other musket and says, two more are dead, and scratches him off. Ah, it's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
It was ripped off in, what was it, Mad Max Fury Road, that moment, where you see where they're hanging at the truck, and then Max goes off into the
into
the fog, hear some explosions and gunfire and whatnot, and then he comes back with some, bearing some treasure.
Yes, the samurai
comes back with the musket.
Yes. I don't know. It's a really good movie. Yeah, Rashomon, Seven Samurai. We should probably wrap up so this doesn't go on for too long. Is there anything else we haven't? I guess we also, in a moment, we will get to who was the most jacked person in Seven Samurai or Rashomon.
Oh, that's easy. Same person. And it's got to be Toshirô Mifune. Especially in Seven Samurai, by the firm butt cheeks that are exposed to that movie.
Lots of butt cheeks.
There's sort of a theme of butts in Seven Samurai that I noted. Like, one of the first villager we hear talking is basically, we hear speaking from a woman's butt. She's just on the ground crying, as so many women are in these movies, with her butt sticking up, and we're hearing the voice coming, basically, from the butt. And there are lots of butts all throughout the movie.
And in that way, the influence of Seven Samurai extends all the way to Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
Exactly.
And Naked Lunch.
There we go. Anyway. Oh, yeah, there we go.
Movies where people talk from butts.
Woo.
All right. So on that note, I will actually leave the audience with this one thing. As we were rewatching the Kurosawa accept the Academy Award for his
Honorary Academy Award.
There we go. His Honorary Academy Award. And I was just expecting, as he took the stage next to George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, that he would just look like Yoda, because he looked like a small Japanese man. And then he was taller than both of them, which was surprising to me. And as we were looking over some stuff prior to this, Konichikawa, the director of Fires on the Plain and whatever, was saying that he was met the young screenwriter Kurosawa before he was a director, and he was immediately struck by the fact that he was very tall and handsome. And so that makes him cool too, because he was apparently very tall. So think good about for that for a Japanese guy. He's taller than Spielberg, and
he's from a samurai family.
That's right.
Had to be big enough to wield those swords in actual defense of feudal lords just a couple generations.
This is true.
Before Kurosawa, born in 1910.
Yes.
And so his father grew up apparently wearing still the samurai topknot.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta remember, Japan basically was still a feudal society as of like 1850 when Western steamships started showing up.
Yeah.
So it was not that long ago, the samurai lifestyle in Mr. Kurosawa's lineage.
Yeah, that's why we see the Ronin in all of his movies as these kind of masterless guys who have inherited the responsibility of some great lineage, but have none of the sort of resources or rewards of that great lineage. So the question becomes, do you succumb to the pragmatism of modernity? Do you succumb to, you know, Western culture? Do you succumb to materialism? Or is it worth it to maintain some aspect of that? And I think that that struggle was something that is... I think that that struggle is where East meets West. I think that is something that you feel even in the souls of movies like, you know, Best Days of Our Lives and My Darling Clementine, and just all this sort of spiritual, It's a Wonderful Life as well, where, George Bailey is going to, you know, is he going to hurl himself into the icy waters or not, because his life didn't really come together exactly as he believed, but then realized that everything was in fact purposeful and transcendent, etc. And I think that meeting place of East meets West, post the entire world being set on fire and nearly dying in a conflagration and being in some sort of spiritually disconnected fallen state. I don't know. If the fundamental purpose of art is unity on some level, to take disparate threads or ideas and unify them in individual people or in stories, to take any dynamic tension or any friction and unify, then kind of speaks to the tremendous dynamic power of Seven Samurai, because whether it's the dynamic tension across eons of time, or at least the intervening decades that have happened since World War II to now, or it is just across the huge cultural divide of a Western, just post-feudal Japanese culture, and a relatively alien, contemporary, modern Western culture, these ideas seem to be completely universal, speaking, if you will, to some sort of universal religion with no name, Cliff. Isn't that right?
Something like that.
There we go. All right. I don't know. So, well, hopefully there's something interesting about Seven Samurai.
I hope
Samurai
we've talked you into seeing these movies if you haven't already seen these movies.
I know.
It was a literally crowded theater in both instances.
Oh,
both,
yes.
Both screenings, including a noon 30 screening at the Draft House, was jam packed.
Yes, mm-hmm. There were multiple screenings this weekend too of Seven Samurai, and I noted that when I came back into the theater, it was packed. Yeah, packed from the back row all the way to people sitting all the way down in the front row. So that is good to know that people, it is still packing them in. And I was trying to think if there were any. I mean, we talked about some of them, like how the big reaction that the comedic moments get in Rashomon at the end. But I don't know. It just plays really well in front of an audience. And I can say that the emotional investment of everyone being tuned in, even to the silent moments and even to what he is doing cinematically, just fills them, not unlike these cups, fills them with a lot more emotion, and just fills those silences with that kind of resonant focus that you only get in a crowded theater. Mm-hmm. And so it was a really, really affecting experience. So anyway, hot take, Rashomon and Seven Samurai are good movies, y'all.
Heck yeah.
Check them out. All right. So until next time, y'all, I am Kyle.
And I'm Taylor.
I am Cliff.
And we will see you in a crowded theater later. Woo!